for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg coming up in mere seconds away as we continue on with the broadcast day. And with that said, let's start this program. Stay tuned for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. It is 7 p.m.
Says Miles Davis. Well, we'll tell you so what. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we're building bridges. Later on, the stand-up strike, the most important strike of now, literally and figuratively, driving the labor movement, and what that could mean for power to those who do the work. Oh, yeah, we're talking about what's happening. Mm-hmm. So what? With a UAW.
First, Tanya Golosh-Boza, professor of sociology and executive director of the University of California Washington Center, author of 6 books that engage around issues of racism, immigrant policy, and human rights, takes us through her newest books, Before the Gentrification, the Creation of D.C.'s Wealth, Racial, Radical Wealth Gap, to grapple with the formidable national issues of loss of housing and dislocation from entire neighborhoods.
So let's get that name right. Before Gentrification, the Creation of D.C.'s Racial Wealth Gap, which, of course, will be a radical departure from much of what is said. Well, it is a pleasure to have Tanya Golosh-Boza with us. And I want to begin by saying, before gentrification lifts the veil on a pattern of anti-blackness and racial capitalism in the nation's capital that has implications for all cities. Tanya Maria Golosh-Boza, take us through those driving forces that result in the loss of now historically black and brown neighborhoods. How did they become the fodder for the new settler colonialism? Vulnerable to be expropriated. What makes neighborhoods of color vulnerable to the expropriation of their housing, of their very communities? And thank you so much for the work that you do and this excellent book, again, Before Gentrification, the Creation of D.C.'s Racial Wealth Gap.
Thank you, Mimi. It's so fantastic to be here. I'd be happy to walk you through that history. Recently I was in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and I asked the owners, you know, how long have you been here? And they're like, oh, we've been here. We were one of the first. You know, we opened about 8 years ago. And I was like, wow, just that erasure, right? Just that idea that there was nothing there, and they came in and they opened this restaurant, and now there's all these great things. I think that you know, when you mention colonialism, that's immediately what I think of when I think of gentrification, is there's just this idea that there was nothing there before. So the reason why my book is titled Before Gentrification is because I think it's so key for us to think about, how did this become a space that is gentrifiable? And by that, I mean, it basically, how did this become a space where it was profitable for people who wanted to make a lot of money to invest? And the reason why they can make a lot of money through investing is because the property values are low, and they figure they can buy up property and then they'll be able to resell it at a higher price later. So how do the property values get low in the first place? Well, that's a long story, which I can share with you if you like.
No, I think it's really important. I think it's critical to understand the processes, the tools really of neoliberalism, racial capitalism that did that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the history is not that long. It's basically the past 100 years. But in Washington, D.C., you have these neighborhoods. I'll do it quickly, though. These neighborhoods were built in the 20s and 30s. And these neighborhoods in uptown Washington, D.C., with these nice brick homes, tree-lined boulevards, they were built for working to middle-class white residents. And they were very explicit about that. The homes have this language in the deeds that say this home shall not be sold to a Negro or a colored person. And those neighborhoods were built for whites. White people moved in droves in the 1940s and 1950s. And then in 1954, we have the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which allowed for school desegregation. So Black people began to move into those neighborhoods and, more importantly, send their children to the local public school. And when that happened, really in the beginning of the school year, 1954, white residents just began to leave very quickly. This is the era of white flight, but it really happened in over the course of 5 to 10 years, nearly all the white residents sold their homes, right? This thing that they had invested in for their future. They sold their homes because Black people were moving in and they did not want to live with Black people. And they certainly did not want to send their kids to school with Black children. So white people moved out to the suburbs, which are still unavailable to Black residents. And Black people began to move into these neighborhoods. And what you want to remember is that these are middle-class Black people who are able to purchase these large brick homes. And they were not purchasing them at a discount at all. But anything, they were purchasing them at an upmarket price. So they buy these homes, move in, and the neighborhood becomes a middle-class Black neighborhood. So it's a nice neighborhood. There's great schools, great communities. But over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, that neighborhood faced disinvestment, which means that the city, as the neighborhood became Blacker, as the neighborhood became almost 95% Black, the city stopped investing in the schools, stopped investing in community centers, stopped investing in local services, and the neighborhood slowly began to experience decline, higher rates of crime. Then you get the 1980s. You mentioned neoliberalism. Well, this is the era when, you know, jobs are being sent overseas. Companies are trying to maximize profits, fire workers, dismantle unions. So unemployment begins to increase and the working wages of workers gets lower. So during this time of crisis, the neighborhood, it really declines. And then, you know, the city's just not investing in the neighborhood what it needs. But then as crime increases and that comes to the attention of Congress, they're like, oh, wait a second, we have to do something about crime. Well, the city officials said, okay, well, sure, let's do something about crime. Let's build drug treatment centers. Let's improve the schools. Let's improve the city services, and let's get more police. And it's only that last call that was answered. So all after decades of not investing in the community, the city and the federal government invest tons of money into policing, which leads to the mass removal, mass incarceration of tens of thousands of Black men. And that creates the landscape for gentrification, right? So now the land is devalued. People have left the neighborhood. Houses are abandoned. And this, now the neighborhood has what's called a rent gap, which is that the houses are priced so low that investors know that if they buy those homes and fix them up, they can then flip them for a profit. And that's exactly what we see happening.
Well, you know, what I'm interested in is the kind of ideological sway during this period that made the political forces there allow for the removal of services and the like, the disinvestment of a solidly middle-class community particularly since it is generally an impression that there were a number of African-American officials there. So, you know, flesh that out more. What was going on with the banking? What was going on with the political policies that, notwithstanding that these were solid middle-class communities, the issue of redlining wasn't going on there. So really, what was happening?
So it didn't happen quickly. It happened very slowly and gradually. So I think that's part of it, is Petworth, the neighbor that I'm talking about in particular, in the 1960s, it was majority Black. The schools were still excellent. They had honors program, AP classes. It's just sort of the schools slowly began to have more students in them. And then the funding wasn't increased. And then the streetlights slowly started to go out one by one, and they're not replaced kind of one by one. So it's kind of this slow drip of disinvestment. And so in that, during that time period, we're talking about before 1974, DC also did not have home rule. So what that means is DC was not self-governing. So these things are all happening, and the people that are making decisions about whether or not to invest in the public school system, which by 1970 was 95% Black, the people that are making those decisions were not African-American. They were mostly white. It was Congress basically making these decisions. And the view that Congress had of Black communities wasn't that there were these upstanding Black communities. It was that these are Black communities. They must be sites of decay. And that sort of prophecy became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's, when we're thinking about the 1960s and 1970s, it's really, DC didn't even have home rule in order to make its own decisions in terms of where to invest. Our officials had to go beg money from Congress, and then they wouldn't give it to them.
The thing that I also just want to get to, some concrete thing, which is definitely in your book, and particularly for people like myself who may not know the individual neighborhoods. One of the things you were talking about was the real estate agents and the federal government worked together first to keep neighborhoods like Eckington and Petworth white, and then to encourage white flight to the suburbs. I mean, how did that work and why? And what can you tell us about those particular neighborhoods to again understand the phenomena, the forces, the tools that go into creating really the expropriation of individual properties, the resultant speculation, and ultimately the gentrification and utter displacement of whole neighborhoods?
Yeah, and you don't have to know Petworth or Eckington. Very similar processes happen in Harlem, although on a different time frame, and also in Brooklyn. So it happened all over the place. But basically what happens is, first, the neighborhoods were built explicitly for white residents. So these urban neighborhoods are built for white residents. So that's a combination of the federal laws, which allow these laws to be put in place that say that you can build a neighborhood just for white residents. And then when the laws changed, and those neighborhoods were not allowed to be only white, the government was complicit with helping to build these suburbs that's had these more kind of covert practices of keeping people of color out. And then as those majority white suburbs grew, the government invested in the school system, invested in highways that would go out to the suburbs, invested in the schools, invested in the resources out there. So this is how you have this kind of confluence of real estate agents wanting to make money off of selling homes, the federal government deciding where to invest. And what we see very clearly in DC, kind of time and time again, is that when a neighborhood is majority white, it receives public investment. But as neighborhoods become majority Black, they stop receiving public investment. And then as neighborhoods become white again, they start getting investment again. It's a very clear pattern that you see kind of over the past 100 years.
So what has the Black community done about this politically in terms of organizing? What is their agenda to fight this?
Yeah, and there actually has been a lot of organizing. So I'll give you a couple of success stories, although they are on a limited scale. But in Washington, D.C., there's a neighborhood called Shepherd Park. And in that neighborhood, as the neighborhood was experiencing white flight, the residents of that community, actually white and Black residents, got together and they organized literally block by block. They would designate each block would have a block captain, and that block captain would be charged with going to every single house in that neighborhood and talking to the residents and saying, hey, real estate agents are going to come around with these cards and they're going to say, we buy homes cash. You probably have seen those cards. It's the same cards they used back then. We buy home cash. They're like, don't sell your home. The real estate agent will try and tell you that the neighborhood is declining. It's not true. We encourage you not to leave. We want to maintain this community as an integrated community. We want to help, you know, improve our schools. So they really organize, I mean, just house by house. It's a remarkable feat of organizing. And they were able to keep Shepherd Park as an integrated community. So we do see some community organizing, but what it seems like is that it just took so much organizing. They were only able to achieve that in this one area of Shepherd Park, a little bit in the neighborhood south of that. But once you get a couple neighborhoods south, they did try to organize those neighborhoods, but the real estate agents and the banks kind of got ahead of them and the people left before they were able to get the organizing effort off the ground.
We're speaking with Tania Maria Galas Bosa before gentrification, the creation of DC's racial wealth gap. And I'm interested in even going back to the title, before gentrification, the creation of DC's racial wealth gap. Let's examine that more. What do you really mean by we're obviously dealing with racial capitalism, but how did that wealth gap get deliberately constructed such that it has everything to do with what property people are not only able to buy, but actually neighborhoods that they're able to hold on to? What's the correlation between income and the policies very often, which are about zoning and other things that lead to the displacement of people from their neighborhoods and policies of redlining and so on? Tie that together for us.
Of course. So here in the U.S., we often think of wealth as being attached to home ownership. So the idea is that if you buy a home, your home will increase in value. You can then pass that home along to your children. They'll be starting off with a base of wealth. So wealth is very connected to home ownership, to intergenerational home ownership. And so a lot of people have thought that, well, we have this huge racial wealth gap, and that's probably because African Americans were cut out of the housing market when this whole wealth building enterprise began, which was in the early to mid 20th century. But what my research shows is that African Americans in DC were not cut out of the home buying enterprise. They were able to purchase homes in large numbers. So in the between 1940 and 1970, the number of African American home owners in DC went from 5,000 to 50,000. So we see a tremendous increase. And moreover, they were able to buy these homes at a 6% interest rate, which was the prevailing interest rate at the time. They were able to secure loans from the Veteran Administration. And these loans, they were able to secure loans for good, for nice, relatively newly built homes. So it's not like they got a bad deal when they bought the homes. I think it's really important to recognize these are African Americans who were successful, that were able to buy homes in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s and 1960s. But what happened is that the neighborhoods where they bought their homes, a lot of those neighborhoods changed. And what that meant is that these homes literally did not increase in value between 1950 and 2000. So they increased in value, but only at the rate of inflation. So that means people are buying homes in 1950 for $12,000. And then by 2000, 50 years later, the home is worth $100,000. It's really not an increase. It's really not a wealth generator when the home value is increasing so slowly over such a long time period. And it's really, 50 years is a long time to hold on to an asset. So what happens is basically the homes didn't increase in value. So therefore, Black people were not enriched through the purchase of homes in the same way that white people were. White people who purchased home, that same home bought in the suburbs in 1950 for $15,000 might have been worth $500,000 by the year 2000. So that's 4 to 5 times greater than the value of the homes in the Black neighborhood. So the reason why we see this huge racial wealth gap is because Black neighborhoods didn't increase in value. And that's directly tied to racial capitalism. So capitalism is just the idea that that the profit system is the basis of our economy. So you purchase something with the goal of, you know, a capitalist is going to purchase something with the goal of making a profit off of it. But that profit is racialized when it comes to the housing market. So if you purchase a home in a white neighborhood, it's going to increase in value more quickly than if you purchase a home in a Black neighborhood. So capitalism in the U.S. is racialized. The housing market is heavily racialized. The housing market has been heavily commodified. And that has racialized impacts in terms of the racial wealth gap.
One of the things that you cover amongst many in the book and help set the stage, and I want to get to this specifically, you start, like, let's go back to the 1950s, which you do. Government subsidized home ownership for whites in D.C., right? So that translates into intergenerational wealth. Why didn't the same hold true for black communities in the later part of the 20th century?
Yes, because black communities experienced disinvestment. So black people in D.C. were able to take advantage of subsidized homeownership. They were able to access the VA loans, the Veteran Administration's loans.
Were they at the same level that white families were?
Yeah, so this is what's remarkable. Is that I find that that's not the problem. The problem is not that black people were locked out of homeownership opportunities in the 1940s and 50s. Of course, there were obstacles. The labor market was racialized. There was inequality. But black people who had the means to purchase homes in the 1950s were able to purchase homes. Like, time and time again, we've looked at the property records, we looked at the mortgage records, and it's extremely clear that black people were able to purchase homes. The problem is that the neighborhoods where they purchased those homes experienced disinvestment, meaning that the state and the private sector stopped investing in those neighborhoods. Let me give you a better picture. So black people, who are doing well in the 1950s, gather the resources to purchase a home. They get a loan at 6% interest rate, subsidized by the Veterans Administration. And when they buy the home, the school down the street is excellent. It has an honors program sending kids to Oberlin in Michigan. There's a grocery store on the corner. There's a deli. There's a theater a couple blocks away. So it seems like a great neighborhood to purchase a home. As they move in, most of the people living in the neighborhood are white. But the neighborhood then slowly becomes majority black. Actually, not slowly, very quickly becomes majority black, because the white people, as soon as the black people move in, white people leave quickly. And as they leave, they often close down, you know, the delis and grocery stores that they own. And then now that the neighborhood is majority black, when black people come in and try and set up their own delis and grocery stores and restaurants, now the neighborhood is majority black. So now it's redlined and they can't get loans to set up those small businesses. It's just, my parents owned a home in Washington, D.C. in a majority black neighborhood. And when we moved from the home in 1985, 10 people put offers on the home. That means that, like, they couldn't get loans. Black people had extreme difficulty getting loans to purchase property. So that is kind of set the stage for the disinvestment and the inability to achieve, the prices that couldn't go up in value because black people who wanted to buy homes in those neighborhoods couldn't even purchase them. So the redlining came later.
And just for people who may not absolutely know, if I may, what redlining is, why don't you define that a little bit for us and how that particularly occurred in D.C. to inform this discussion?
Yeah, so the word redlining comes from the fact that the federal government used to mark in red neighborhoods where black people lived and said, we will not underwrite loans in those neighborhoods. So they would literally mark the neighborhood red on the map. So that's where the title comes from. But what's important to understand that today, redlining just means that a bank will say, you know, we're not going to give loans in that neighborhood, or we're going to charge higher interest rates in that neighborhood. So the neighborhood that I'm talking about, when it was majority white, it was not redlined. It was greenlined. It was literally green line on the map made by the federal government. But as it became majority black, there's evidence that banks stopped giving loans in that neighborhood. So that's what we understand today as redlining, kind of in the colloquial sense, because the maps were made at one point in time and neighborhoods have changed since then.
And the banks did this because they think they couldn't make a profit on those specific loans, or they consciously tried to change the neighborhood and turn it white?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why the banks did it? There's documentary evidence, for example, that the Chevy Chase Bank would tell its loan officers, "Okay, guys, we're not gonna make any loans east of Rock Creek Park or south of DuPont Circle." So there's a document. There's like a memo. So we know for sure that they were saying that. As to why, I know that's going to be speculation, but presumably they believe that and I guess the federal government made it a little more explicit. They said these neighborhoods are not likely to increase in value. So I guess the banks were also saying, well, those neighborhoods are majority black. They're not going to increase in value. So people might default on those loans. They're not going to accrue value over time. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you say, like, we won't invest in that neighborhood because it's not going to increase in value. And then you don't invest in it. And then, of course, if that becomes true, it does not increase in value.
Tanya, the issue of the importance of communities that have been historically treated disparately in terms of course, the wage market, in terms of the issue of when will we be paid for the work we did as forced labor that was dragooned here, that was brought here in chains. All of this has to do with kind of generational wealth, and housing is considered a major component and representation of anchoring community, of generational wealth, and so on. So the importance and the significance of this issue, and also for political power of breaking up neighborhoods that had actually a significant number of black home ownership. Put that all together for us and what it means.
Yeah, certainly. So there's so many instances in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure in other cities, but D.C. was the focus of my research, where there were neighborhoods full of black homeowners. And the federal government would just come along and say, you know, we're going to we declare this neighborhood a slum. We declare it unfit. We declare it unfit for human living. And they would just clear it out. And they would do this over and over again. The people that were removed, you know, wouldn't receive just compensation. And particularly if you think about the fact that, I mean, there's some of these, there's a neighborhood in Reno City in Washington, D.C., in a neighborhood that to this day is still majority white. It's where Brett Kavanaugh grew up, and no, it's where Mike Pence lives or lived when he was vice president. So you kind of imagine the kind of neighborhood it was. That neighborhood had in the middle of it a black community, and the Chevy Chase land company insisted that that black community needed to be raised because they needed to build a school and a park there, and that was the only location in the whole neighborhood for the school and the park. So they fought back and forth, you know, for a long time. The people that lived in Reno City did not give up easily, but eventually the Chevy Chase Land Company, along with the Department of Parks, won out, and they removed that landowning community from there. So that land today is worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars. So that is land, that's money that was stolen from those African Americans who had gone to great lengths to purchase land in that neighborhood.
And I'm wondering if you can talk about the experiences that you have in Washington, the issue of gentrification in D.C. How comparable is it to processes unfolding in other U.S. cities? And what are the social implications if we look at New York, if we look at Los Angeles, if we look at areas like San Francisco or Compton or, for goodness sake, Chicago and the like? Your thoughts on that. What does this mean for a country, and what does it mean for the African American community?
I think when we think broadly about the United States and we think about cities, the problem is that there's been a return to the city movement. So all of the descendants of those white families that just fled the cities in the 1950s, their children, their grandchildren want to come back to the city. The cities have been, mayors around the country have kind of have sold their cities as hip places to live, as cool places to live. And all of that has created more demand for cities. So of course now people with more resources can live in cities, and people who have less resources are pushed out to other places farther away from the jobs in the city center. But the problem is that now housing prices have increased kind of all across the United States. Housing prices in cities have increased. But the issue that people forget is that cities need workers. And we don't just need remote workers we need people in the city to fix the potholes, to drive the buses, to drive the taxis, to work at CVS, to work at Walgreens. Like, we actually need people in the city to work. But then the people that work in those jobs don't earn enough money to live in the city. So now we have a situation in a lot of places. You have people that drive, you know, 1 hour, 2 hours to come to the city that work. You have people that live in their parents' house, people that share, you know, multiple families to a home, and people that sleep in their cars, right? And all of that is not sustainable. So kind of, so cities across the nation really have to grapple with how do we provide affordable housing for workers, right? And cities have decided kind of not to deal with that for the most part, and that's not going to work. But the interesting thing is, the United States has faced this issue before, you know, in the aftermath of World War II. The federal government was like, you know, we're going to need some housing for those soldiers when they come back, and they're going to probably want to start families. We should build housing for them. You know, we should make sure that they have access to housing. And that was the birth of public housing in the United States. It began, you know, in the 30s and the 40s. And at that time, the federal government thought, you know, it was a good idea to build housing for people. And it did. But unfortunately, we've really turned away from this idea of providing housing for people. Housing as a human right. And instead, housing has become commodified, which means that now only people who have tremendous resources can really afford to live in cities.
Well, of course, you know, there isn't a statutorily a human right in this country for housing. It's definitely not enshrined. In New York, there is the right to shelter in the state constitution, but human rights and housing are not something that exists in this country. So what I'm wondering is, in your research and your understanding, using as a prototype Washington, D.C., the irony, right? The nation's capital. I don't know why it should be, since there isn't a home rule and it isn't a state with independent voting privileges and so on. But nevertheless, there's a political irony to D.C. being as segregated as it is. The gentrification process, but short of dismantling capitalism, I must say that as a tenants' rights practitioner for decades in my other life, I just not understanding how the real estate market, which profits off of the control of where people live and how they live, and benefits and is a political climate that is accentuating and almost demanding segregation and pushing people out. Black lives does not matter. So how do you see kind of what proposals come forward to this to begin to create neighborhoods that are not subject to the zoning changes, to the redlining and various other policies of government and the private real estate market that are going to result in speculation, result in gentrification and the utter displacement of people? That's an awful lot, but God knows it's a national phenomena, and we're really looking to some answers or thoughts on that so that, housing does become a human right.
Yeah, so, I mean, the United States has a history of taking land. They usually, in D.C., they've generally taken it from Black people, but they really could take the land from anywhere. But we have a strong history of taking land and building housing on it, right? Like, the government apparently has the right to do that, because it certainly has done it in the past many, many times. So public housing continues to be a viable option. So the reason why housing is so expensive really is the land is so expensive. But the city, the state, the federal government have tons of land, and they could give it to an organization that could build housing for people. And then the people that live there could pay a portion of their rent, and they could use that money to maintain the building, which is what public housing was originally designed to be. But we don't just have public housing. We also have, in Washington, D.C., we have cooperatives. I know you have them in New York as well. So a cooperative is a building that's collectively owned by the tenants. And the value of that is that if you live in a cooperative, then the tenants themselves manage the building. They decide, you know, how much to increase the rent each year based on the expected costs. So the money is not being siphoned off to a developer or to an owner. Instead, the costs of the building maintenance are shared collectively. And we have many examples of successful cooperatives in D.C. and in New York and other cities. So, but both of those things, public housing and cooperatives, are decommodified housing. So the only way we're going to have housing for people within capitalism, housing for working people within capitalism, is to decommodify housing. Now, of course, a lot of people get scared by that because we so strongly believe in the United States that our wealth is tied to the value of our lands. And that's true, but that has worked out way better for white people than it has for Black people. So holding on to that belief in the commodification of housing is one of the factors that enhances racial disparities in the United States.
Well, I must say, you've struck a note of a chord with me when you talk about public housing, when you talk about what I call housing in the public domain, the fact that a government has the mandate. Indeed, that's what our taxes are for. It's for Medicare for all, a health care system that is universal. It's about providing housing for those with no income, those who are elderly, those who are disabled, those who are low income, all of that for a humane and just society. Tanya Galaj Boza, the line that you've drawn between redlining and incarceration and gentrification in an American city is an absolute battle cry and a roadmap, really, to dismantle the carceral state and to make central the struggle for, I would say, also reparations as a part of seeking wage equity and an equal distribution of wealth. And for democracy to exit, to exist at its core, we must have egalitarianism. And it seems to me that is the central theme of what you've written about in Before Gentrification, the creation of DC's racial wealth gap. And I encourage all to read this, to get a real handle on what's happening in their city. And this is every city in the U.S. so that we can move to the maintenance and creation of an egalitarian, the beloved community that Martin Luther King waxed so eloquent about. Tanya Galaj Boza, thank you for the work you do. And again, get the book, read it. Before Gentrification, the creation of DC's racial wealth gap, and apply the lessons to your city.
Thank you, Mimi. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. It's a great book.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. Every single one of them are in cahoots. He's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia, too. He's a white man in a business suit. The stream to get a little drink. The water was dark and murky and it sure did sting. I went upstream to find the source of the spill. There was a chemical plant on top of the hill. I asked for the owner of this place of ill repute. He was a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit.
Well, that says it all. Mike Stout saying it all. White man in a business suit. We're using that as the symbol of Stellantis, of the Ford plant, of GM. Stellantis, by the way, who people may not know, is the kind of parent entity of Chrysler. So, hey, white men in a business suit by Mr. Mike Stout takes us into our next segment, Ken.
We're joined now by Luis Feliz Leon, formerly the lead organizer of La Fuente in Queens, and then labor journalist whose beats include the building trades, workers' centers, and farm workers. an assistant editor for Labor Notes, who most recently has been tackling the preparation for the stand-up strike.
The stand-up strike, indeed. In fact, the UAW strike is so much a part of him. His voice on the emails I've tried to contact him on and so on, I get blares out repeatedly. No justice, no jeeps. Okay, so he didn't say that, but he might as well have, because that's the passion he brings to the issue and the research. No justice, no jeeps. It's good to have you with us, Luis.
Luis,
thank you for inviting me one more time.
Oh, well, in fact, you've been very many times. You're fantastic. But do you want to start off by recounting the major issues the UAW struck GM, Ford, and Stellantis, parent company of Chrysler? What's going on there?
So, yeah, so 146,000 auto workers, their contracts expired on September 14th. Of those 146,000, only 13,000 are out on strike right now at assembly plants in Michigan, Ohio, and Missouri. And they are fighting for a just contract after decades of concessions, of efforts to reform their union so they could actually take on the companies. So they're demanding a pay raise of more than 40% to match the record profits that the big three automakers have, CEOs have given themselves, saying that record profits mean record contracts. They are demanding an end to tiers that are solidarity wrecking divisions within a workforce. They are demanding a reinstatement of COLA, which was given away after the, which was suspended, I should say, after the 2009, after the bailouts.
And so that's COLA, of course, for people who may not know, the cost of living increase that they gave up during that period, and they want it back.
Right, so that their salaries keep up with inflation, right? So that's the COLA, cost of living adjustments are pegged to inflation. So those are some of the highlights of the things they're demanding. They're also demanding job security. Just today, It was revealed that Stellantis' proposal included the closure of 18 plants in the U.S. So they want to ensure that as we transition from gas-powered vehicles to electric vehicles, that there is a plan in place to make sure that those workers aren't left behind, because the assembly process for an EV factory is very different than the current setup that we have. So those are some of the highlights of what they're fighting for. But the big punchline here is that they are fighting for what is due to them after decades of concessions. And the country is with them. More than 75% of Americans are standing with them. This fight has revitalized the labor movement. I was in Michigan over the weekend. I am really tired. My voice is as low as you can hear.
Yelling no jeeps, no justice?
You bet I was. I definitely take a side in this fight. I'm standing with the workers. So I'll pause there.
Well, instead of just pausing, what was the reaction of the auto companies to these demands? And did the union think that was enough? Are they still fighting? What's going on?
Of course, they're definitely still fighting. The response from the companies was complete confusion. You know, an industry mouthpiece called Automotive News had put out a paper how a potential UAW strike would have significant ramifications on auto logistics. And in it, they listed all the plants that were not the ones that ultimately were struck. So the companies, they responded to the looming strike by stockpiling and, you know, putting in place their contingency plans. The point of a strike is that a strike is a weapon wielded by workers to force companies to meet their demands. So in the past, in 2019, for instance, workers went on strike at GM and they got a measly 3% raise after being out for 40 days. And it was performative. It was, let's take you out to the picket line for some vigorous shouting, some exercise, get in your steps. But ultimately, there was no real strategy to force the companies to give in to workers' demands. The workers didn't even know what the union was fighting for at the bargaining table. It was all behind closed doors. So right now, the companies are confused. They don't know what to make of Sean Fain. You know, on CNBC, they're saying, is Sean Fain, you know, a Trotskyist? Who is this man? You know, Sean Fain is not a Trotskyist. Sean Fain is just a working class man that's fed up. Plain spoken Midwestern man from Ohio, from Kentucky. His family's originally from Kentucky, as was Eugene Debs. And this is something that these companies haven't seen. You know, we saw this. We have seen this repeatedly during the pandemic. These companies underestimate working class people. They think they're better than us. They think they have all the answers. And when we put on a formidable fight, we knock them off that pedestal. We challenge that arrogance. We challenge that condescension that they have towards us. And that's what we are seeing. We are seeing these companies scrambling, trying to make sense of what's going on. So the strike, the strategy, the stand-up strike strategy is to hit the company where it hurts the most, to keep them guessing. They use divide and conquer tactics against us. Right now, the union is doing that to them. They're trying to figure out. Ford was most likely surprised that they were struck. The last time Ford Motor Company was struck was in 1976. They pride themselves in being a family-owned business. So what you are seeing right now is that these companies are trying to figure out, okay, how can we make this stop? What are we going to do to appease the workers, right? And the company, the union is standing firm behind these bold demands. So that's that's what's happening right now.
You know, I have to say, you know, you mentioned Sean Fain. Sean Fain, I'm a member of the UAW. Sean Fain came in on a Democratic platform after a significant part of the top leadership of the UAW wound up going to prison for corruption and stuff. And we began to fight hard in the membership. And finally, under the leadership of Sean Fain, there's been a democratization of the union. So, yes, he is from the ranks, which many of us have enormous confidence in. But the union is caught on a real terrible horns of a dilemma. And some of that came out, interestingly, at the climate march yesterday. And this is about the shift to electric vehicles, which has a number of contradictions, right? There are those who say, well, the shift to electric vehicles will reduce the number of quality jobs in the auto industry. And that's the backdrop for the strike of the UAW. Union officials have made it clear their belief that the auto industry is using the technological transition to mask a second economic transition, meaning they worry that the companies are using the shift from internal combustion engines to carbon-free electric vehicles to shift more of their operations from high-paying union jobs, mostly in northern states, to lower-paying non-union jobs in southern states. So that's a thread running through all of this. To what degree has there been discourse on this? And how in hell's name is the union to deal with this contradiction of exactly that, that you want to get rid of the extractive industries that are destroying the planet, and at the same time, yep, we've got these jobs that could very easily head to the South and non-union states. Your thoughts on that, or to what extent have you seen discourse on these issues by the union?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So there's no contradiction in terms of the union's position on the EV transition. They're for it. What they want is to make sure that there's some guardrails, that there's some protections, so that the jobs that are created are in bad jobs, are in dangerous, hazardous jobs that pay poverty wages. That's the sticking point. But the mainstream media has tried to paint the union in some instances as not being, you know, for the transition. Trump is right now threatening to skip the second GOP debate and rally with auto workers in Michigan.
Wait a minute, He's threatening to, he's going to rally with auto workers, Trump?
Yeah, that's what he's saying, that he, that's what he's saying that he's going to do. So, you know, we are living in a moment of a lot of demagoguery and
talk about dystopian universes.
Right. And he's exploiting the fact that, yeah, workers are, as they should be, concerned about how these companies have gotten billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies to create shit jobs. So when we talk about the green economy, we talk about, or at least in my head, the image that I conjure is one of a pastoral, beautiful scenery. But the reality, as we spoke last time I was on your radio program, when we spoke about the Lordstown OTM cells plant, was one of hazardous conditions of fires. It was really dystopian inside that plant. So what the union is saying is we want job security for the workers in our contract that could potentially face being dislocated as more and more plants become EV plants as opposed to internal combustion, building internal combustion engines and cars, right? So they're just asking for a just transition. That is a very practical and sensible demand. However, there are some points that are important to emphasize. One of those points is that the union cannot negotiate over joint ventures. It's a legal fiction that these joint ventures are not part of the master, or cannot be part of the master contract. So what the big three have done is they've created separate companies, creating in essence a second tier workforce so that they can exploit them, pay them different wages as auto workers in the big three. So the union and its allies have been talking about the standards in the EV plants should mirror the standards in big three contracts, including standards around safety and standards around good wages. So some people in the media have misreported that and made it seem as though the union can actually negotiate in this round about EVs. The union cannot do that. You know who can do that? President Biden. He has the power to demand that, put some strings on all the money that the administration is giving to these companies to make sure that he's building a high road transition and not a low road transition that leads to bad jobs.
Would that also be
unsafe jobs?
Luis, would that also be suggesting that we're talking about that plants, that new plants that open up, retooling plants, they must be union jobs? Is that even on the table as part of what's being looked at? It certainly isn't anything that's said by the Biden administration. But is the union also saying, hey, while you're closing, you just mentioned 18 plants, while you're laying off workers all over the place now, the idea of the jobs that are created by EVs, they must be union jobs. Is that crazy to think that that would be built into a negotiation?
Well, in this instance, they can't do that. It's not a permissive subject of bargaining because these are separate companies. So the union cannot demand that from these EVs. What they can do, for instance, there are already EV plants that are part of the big three. In Michigan, there's a factory called Factory Zero where they build electric vehicles for GM. So those jobs already exist. So they can bargain over that. What I'm saying is that the president can demand and say what you just said. These must be not only union jobs, but good union jobs. Ford is building a plant in Michigan that where they basically signed a neutrality agreement with the UAW. This was before Sean Fain came into office. This was during the Curry administration. And it's not a joint venture. So some of these jobs are going to be union jobs. The sticking point is what kind of union jobs, right? Are we And this is why right now, any listener, if folks are listening to you in Mississippi and Alabama, if they're working at a foreign transplant factory, meaning those are factories owned by Honda, Mercedes, any of these other automakers, they should be reaching out to the UAW. The UAW is fighting. You need a fighting union on your side. But in the past, what's happened is that the union hasn't organized the South. And that is also a threat, to kind of touch on the second part of your question. So one way that the companies are strategizing is they're saying, if you don't lower your expectations, we're going to ship the jobs to Mexico, or we're going to move the jobs to Alabama, Mississippi. That's the threat that the companies make, right? So the response to that, is when it comes to on both fronts, it's for Mexico, it's international solidarity. The standards need to go up, and they have been going up. There's an independent union movement in Mexico that desperately needs the support of the U.S. labor movement. On the moving jobs to the South, that means that there needs to be new organizing of those facilities. And the union, for the first time, is in a position where workers actually can say, we want to build a union in our workplace, and we want to do it with the UAW. That is something that happens when you actually fight. But there's another point, Mimi, that I want to make sure that we don't mischaracterize. When I say that Stellantis is closing, or is proposing to close, it hasn't done this. This is what they're proposing, 18 plants. It doesn't mean they're going to lay off those people. What they're saying is, we're going to close the plants, and those people are going to transfer somewhere else. So the jobs will remain, so that the plants won't be there. But guess what? That's how they started at Belvedere. They started by eliminating the second shift. And now, then they brought the headcount down further until they used the euphemism to say that they have indefinitely idled the plant, which in plain English means they closed down the plant, right? So this is why the union is fighting for job security and wants some guarantees. It wants the right to strike over plant closures, right? So it gets a little complicated because these companies, this is how nefarious they are. They play these mind tricks to scare people, but the union is standing up to them. And this is why they also had to use a strategy that would not just get people out in the out on the picket lines and have a good experience, because it's good to be on a picket line. They had to make sure that those picket lines were effective. One point that is important for your listeners to understand is that during the past administration, the union has successfully decoupled striking from winning. The union had decoupled striking from winning. Let that sink in. So the end all and be all for all of the labor movement, we love the strike for a lot of good reasons, right? Because it builds the union. People have an experience of their class power. But at the end of the day, the strike is supposed to win something for workers. It's supposed to show that if we fight, we win. We are living right now through a moment that is equivalent to the PATCO moment. If the UAW wins this fight, it's gonna have the most impactful ramifications for the labor movement in decades. If it loses this fight, it will have a chilling effect. So we all have to rally around the UAW and support these workers on strike.
No, not even a concept, not even a hint, not even a whisper of we will do anything other than win when we stand up with this strike, when we stand with their families, their workers, with the working class. This strike is formative. It is the most important strike of this generation. And we are there to make sure that it prevails. And we thank you for your being the emissary of the workers. We're going to insist that you come back on a regular basis till we see this thing through to its logical conclusion. And we're going to continue to yell, hey, no justice, no Jeeps. Right, Luis?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So we've been speaking with Luis Felix Leon. who is an organizer, a labor journalist extraordinaire with the Labor Notes. And he has been covering extensively and will continue to bring us reports. The Stand Up Strike. You go UAW. No justice, no jeeps. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we are building bridges, saying organize, organize, organize.
Thank you.